format calls for guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will share for between 30 and 45 minutes before calling on people to share. During the open discussion portion of the meeting, we ask that you just keep in mind that we'd like to have everybody get a chance to share. And it is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chair speaker. This is Sharon from Hayward. And I had the privilege of meeting Sharon. She was the speaker for a concepts, a group that gets together once a month on Tuesdays and talks about the 12 concepts. And I found her presentation riveting. And I can't wait to learn more about our friend Sharon. So Sharon, please.
Well, thank you, Bill. My name's Sharon, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can say hi to everybody. Hi, Mike. Hi, New Hope. I am so excited that you guys are there. And I've got a lot to say. I feel like it now, but it's because you guys are here. It really, I'm glad to see you, Jesse and Courtney. Thanks for reading. And, I definitely want to talk about my time I spent in a place kind of like that up in Seattle. That's why I get really excited. You know, like I'm even studying the furniture and stuff because it, I don't know, I get a little nostalgic. So I'm glad to be piped into where you guys are. I have a sobriety date, and my sobriety date is February 29th of 1992. So this was the big year for me where I was going to be 29 years sober on the 29th of February, which there was, I know, thank you, I saw that you saw that right away. There was no 29th this year. I'll never have that moment, but I'm okay. You know, I love my sobriety date. I do. I take such good care of it because it's not the only one I've had. I had some really good ones that I really thought were going to stick. Like I had April 13th. That was a big sobriety date for me. If you had asked me when I had that sobriety date, Sharon, will you ever drink again? I would have said no, you know, and I meant it. I was never going to drink again. And then I had one in May. I guess that one wasn't as special. But I know that if you asked me, Sharon, are you ever going to drink again? I would have said absolutely not. One of my all-time favorites was January 7th. I had that one. Now, notice my real sobriety date is February 29th. January 7th, I would have told you that is it. I will never drink again. And I got to say that January 7th is where I'm sitting in a place like you guys are. And I'm desperately miserable is what I am. I am miserable because, something's wrong with me. And I've been trying to be sober for a couple years now. And I'm sitting in a place in Seattle with comfy furniture and 30 women that I hate because they were so happy. And I didn't get why they were so happy. I was dying. AA didn't work. It didn't work for me because I was sitting in a place like this. I hated everybody. They brought a meeting into me on Tuesday nights, and the AA people came in, and I just glared at the AA people. I glared at them, and we went around the table, and everybody was saying, my name's Kristen. I've got 16 days. And it was like, hooray. And I'm like, I had 16 days. I had 9 months. I had 9 months twice. I'm a 9 month wonder. I know everything at 9 months. I can quote the book and tell you what you should be doing, and I can't stay sober, you know. And so when it came my turn at the table, I refused to play that game. I wouldn't announce myself. I wouldn't say how many days. I was so angry. And so I'm smiling because, you know, the bad thing about me sitting there is that they were going to let me out. And I didn't want to be let out because AA doesn't work. Therapy didn't work. I paid a therapist one time $120 to fall asleep. I was pouring my heart and soul out. She fell asleep. I don't know if you guys have had that happen. But, you know, I knew they were going to let me out. And the reason I tell this story to start with is that I begged them to keep me. I begged them, and they let me out. And by the time I got out, I thought, I'm staying sober this time. And I believed it. And, you know, they were telling me, all right, go get a home group in AA when you got out. I thought, that's great. I've had one for 2 years. I've got a home group. They told me, go get a sponsor. I already had one. I don't know if she knew that she was my sponsor, but I thought, I got that checked out. Go to a meeting right away. And I said, I will. I was on board. And where I, the treatment center I was in, all of the women on your day of discharge, they stood and they put their arms up like this, and you ran through the tunnel into the world again, and they gave you a chip, and I ran through the tunnel of recovery, and I went back to work. And my apartment was a mess. It was a mess. I had to clean it up. I was behind on everything. I did not go to an AA meeting. I went back to work, and, you know, on February 28th, they invited me out to lunch, and, you know, and I went out to lunch, and we went to a Greek restaurant, and at that Greek restaurant, this guy, really nice guy, was sitting next to me. He doesn't know I've been in AA for 2 years. He didn't know where I had been for what turned out to be about 7 weeks. He didn't know where I'd gone, and he looks at me, and he says, "Hey, Sharon, you got to try this Greek wine. It tastes like wood." And I took the glass from him and I drank it, and I had nothing come into my head at all. I had nothing. There was no thought, "Sharon, you've been in a treatment center for 6 weeks." Nothing. There was no, like, "Sharon, you've been in AA trying to get sober for 2 years." I had nothing come in my head. I picked it up and I thought, "Oh my God, I gotta try it. It tastes like wood." It was the darkest, most horrible drink of my entire life. And the reason it is because when I was done, I thought, what have I done? And I watched it and I thought, I will drink forever. I knew I will drink forever. I will drink forever, you know, because nothing came into my head. And it turned out, as you know, that's my sobriety date. That was my last drink. But if you had hooked me up to a lie detector test that day, I would have said, I will always drink. There is no hope. And it just turns out for me, that was the day of the most hope, because I really understood my problem. And so I've got a sobriety date. And I've got a home group. It's a big part of my recovery. We meet on Saturdays in San Jose. When you get out, I want you guys to come hang out with me. So if anybody comes anywhere near Saturday nights at 8 p.m. in San Jose, I am always there. And we are in person and online. So I look forward to that. I've also got a sponsor. And, boy, you know, her job is to poke fun at me, I think. Her job is to get me laughing. I'm very serious. I'm not serious about you guys. Like, I like to laugh, but I am, like, really serious about myself. And so she has to poke little holes at me all the time to get me not to take myself so seriously. I love that woman. You know, I really think that I want to grow up and be just like her. That she is so humble that she would be angry that I'm talking about how humble she is. So there you go. And I have commitments and AA, and I also, you know, I get to sponsor some women, and it's a really good life. But you guys, I am so shy. I don't know if there's anybody shy in that house. I am so shy. I've been this way my whole life. When the shyness comes on, it could come on any second, and I start to get kind of weird. And then I get awkward, and I say things, and then I get weirder and more shy, and I've been this way my whole life. And I grew up in a really small little logging town where everybody knew each other, you know. But every year it seemed like I was more shy, and all the other girls were closer and closer and closer. And what happened is that, you know, I didn't know anything about drinking. My parents do not drink. They are not normal drinkers. I'm sure they want me to put that on the end of that. So I didn't know anything about what drinking, you know, I never saw it. And at 15 years old, I got invited to go to a drinking party. And it was with girls I'd known since first grade, and I was terrified. I did not want to go, you know. And my best friend had to convince me to go to the drinking party. And reluctantly, I went. I was so scared. And, you know, I went over to this girl's house, and we went in the basement, and there were 10 of us. We're all 15, and they had the bar set up with 3 bottles of champagne, little plastic champagne glasses, and I'm terrified. I know I'm standing against the wall thinking, what am I going to say if somebody talks to me? You know, I'm thinking, what am I, I'm a mess. and somebody poured me a glass of champagne, and I honestly thought it was a beverage. I knew nothing. I thought it was like, would you like some Kool-Aid? It was like, or Diet Coke. And so they poured me a glass of champagne, and I drank mine like everybody else did, but I was pretty sure mine was like rancid. Like it had gone bad. They'd let it, you know, there's something wrong with it. But the other girls were drinking it, and I drank mine, and I don't know that big things happened to me with that first drink, but they poured me a second glass of champagne. And I like to think I stood a little taller. You know, I could breathe a little bit. I'm looking around the room thinking, these girls seem nice. You know, and then they poured me my third glass of champagne, and the miracle happened. It turns out I'm cute and funny. And I have never been cute and funny in my whole life. I am shy, awkward, weird, messed up, but now I'm cute and funny, and, you know, we're flying around the basement like little airplanes, and we don't drive. We didn't go out and get DUIs. You know, we're 15 years old. It's the most innocent party I've ever been to, and oh, my God, I wanted to do that again. I was, you know, I could talk to the girls. I could say, tell me how you've been since first grade. You know, catch me up on everything. We were friends, and it turns out that first night, even though I didn't come from a family that drank, I seemed to know more about drinking than the other girls did. I knew that 3 bottles of champagne and 10 teenage girls had been really poor planning. You know, I knew that. And I knew to watch that last bottle of champagne. And I did. And I watched when it got down to that last inch and a half. And I thought, all right, all 10 of us are going to make this run for the ball. And I was poised and I was ready. And I walked right up to it. And I poured that last glass. They were watching the bottle. Why were they not watching? And it was really important to me that I get that last glass of champagne. And so I don't know if I'm an alcoholic at 15. I don't know if I was that night. But I sure had some different behavior than the other girls did. And I sometimes think that what happened to me is that I really think I have an allergy to alcohol, you know, like it talks about in the big book. I think that the phenomenon of craving set in. I took the first drink, you know, and I got thirsty. You know, and that's the story of my whole drinking. I get thirstier when I pick up a drink. And it doesn't happen with, I've got a nice sparkling water here. I may not finish it. I don't get the phenomenon of craving with it. But if this is bourbon, I got to go to the liquor store soon. And so I really have this weird allergy. My whole life changed that night. I was cute and funny. I came to life, and in about 30 days, it turns out I'm not cute and funny. I'm not. I'm obnoxious when I drink. I don't have a stopper, and I drink really quickly. I don't know if there's any quick drinkers out there, but I'm fast, and I don't have a stopper, and I get angry when I drink. It turns out I yell obscenities, and I know you guys don't know me very well, but isn't that hard to picture me just yelling obscenities? And, you know, I do. I jump out of cars. I am the crazy girl in the middle of the intersection, and it's like pouring down rain at 2 a.m., and they're chasing her, trying to get her back in the car. That's who I am when I drink. And I don't even know why I'm mad. I'm obnoxiously drunk, and I pass out, I black out, and I am having the time of my life. My parents, unfortunately, were not having the time of their lives because they don't know what's going on with me. You know, and I don't know about your family. My family does not communicate well. To this day, we can tell if my mom's angry because she'll leave little post-its all over. Like there'll be a post-it on the counter. Put garbage under the sink. There'll be a post-it on the fridge. You know, clean this off. But there's no communication. You can just tell, ooh, it's a bad post-it morning in the house. And so nobody ever took me aside and said, wow, Sharon, what's going on with you? The most I ever got, you guys, I made friends too. I made friends with a couple of really nice older gentlemen in their late 30s, and I'm 15. And I was so flattered by their attention, and my parents were not. My parents were like, oh my God, you know. And one day my new friends came up and they honked their horn for me to come out. For some reason they wouldn't come out and knock on the door of my parents' house. You know, but, you know, the post-it and the communicating thing, I remember waving to my mom and dad, see you later, I'm going out with my new lovely friends I've made. And all my dad could say to me, and I can still see him to this day, he said, take it easy on the, and he didn't say drinking, but he did this. He made the symbol for it. And I'm just like, bye, you know, and I could care less. I'm having the time of my life. I have arrived. I am having fun. And I'll just tell you about the progression of my drinking is that in high school, I cannot wait to go to the party. Maybe I'm shy and awkward and weird, but I don't care. I'll go to the football game. Are we going to meet at halftime? Are we meeting afterwards? You know, where I grew up, it was a logging town. All the big parties were in the forest. You know, with AC/DC, these were the good days. Blaring, you know, in the darkness and kegs of beer. I can't wait to go to the party. And I went to college and my drinking was already different. When I got to college, I needed a drink to go drinking. I don't know if you've ever, I needed a drink to go drinking. When did that happen? I didn't see like that I crossed some line, but I really wanted to go to a drinking party my first night on campus, and I just kept thinking, if I just had a drink, I could go to the drinking party. And I was so, I'm scared of you guys, not you guys, but I'm scared of everybody. And, you know, I didn't go to the drinking party that night because I couldn't get a drink. But the best thing in my drinking career happened to me that night. My sister went to the same college. She's my older sister, valedictorian, senior class president. I've been in her shadow my whole life. She's 13 months older. Good girl. Doesn't drink. My first night on campus at about 3 a.m, there's this knock on the door, and I opened the door, and it was my sister. And I opened the door. She fell flat onto the floor. She was drunk, and we became best friends. You know, we did. She did all the hard work. She had made all of the drinking friends for me. I just walked right into the greatest group of drinking friends I've ever had. And I did two things really well in college. One of them was chemistry, which I don't like. I really don't. I don't like chemistry. I took a lot of chemistry. And it turns out if you take a lot of chemistry, you graduate with a degree in chemistry, which I do not enjoy. And I wish somebody could have just said, you know, Sharon, if you major, I graduated with honors in chemistry. This is how crazy it is. I wish somebody could have just said, you know, you're probably going to become a chemist. Because the other thing I did really well was drink. And I think that's why I just took chemistry. I was drinking and taking chemistry, and I graduated a daily drinker. And I am telling you right now, nobody was saying, Sharon, thank you for the 4 years you spent with us. They were not. The chemistry department, they never told me how much they enjoyed my company. You know, it turns out they didn't like it the time that the fire trucks had to come on campus. We had paramedics one day. That was really upsetting to a lot of people. You know, they don't like ambulances coming. They didn't like that I moved into the chemistry building because I didn't apply to live in the dorms that year. It was my senior year, and I just picked a nice room in the chemistry building, and I moved into it, you know. And that upset a lot of people because they had just purchased this $500,000 nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, and I moved in. They had a fridge, you know. I put my bourbon in there, you know. I had my cat, and you know, and campus security came and they said, ma'am, you're going to have to leave. And I think they were glad when I graduated. And so I graduated a daily drinker, and I'm not a daily drunk. And I think that's always been confusing to me, because if you ask me what an alcoholic is, I would have said an alcoholic is drunk every day, and I'm not, but I drink every day. And I got a job working at Oregon Health Sciences University in chemistry, and I'm messed up. I am so messed up. All my drinking friends moved away, and now I need a drink. You know, I need a drink to be with the people of the world, and I'm a good girl. I go to work. I don't miss a day, but I drink every day. You know, and I come home every day after work with my 6 16-ounce Schlitz, and I put them in the fridge, and I go back to my room, and I drink. And sometimes I just have two. I don't know why. Some days I would just have two. I would fall asleep in front of the television, and that's normal drinking. Everybody does that. And then there'd be days where I would think, tonight, Sharon, you're just going to have two, and you're going to fall asleep in front of the television, and I don't. I drink all six. You know, and somehow I've driven down to Captain Billy Bang's to drink. And, you know, you can tell, don't go to Captain Billy Bang's. Nothing good ever happened to me at Captain Billy Bang's. And, you know, and I'm driving in a blackout. I drive through front yards. I hit fire hydrants. I clip off mirrors. And it's daylight probably, too. That's my worst problem. If I start drinking too early in the day, there's a lot of daylight left, and I cannot stop drinking once I start. I really can't, you know, and I don't know what my problem is. I drank through a really bad kidney infection, destroyed Lefty. Lefty doesn't work anymore, but I'm keeping him. Nobody's getting Lefty. You know, I lost a whole, I dropped a lot of weight really fast because I was just drinking bourbon. You know, I was just drinking bourbon, and I liked it, except for that I fainted all the time. Which, you know, it just seemed like the people around me were really uncomfortable, because we'd be talking and boom, you know, and I fainted, you know. There was stuff wrong with me. There was a lot wrong with me, and I was lonely. I have never been more lonely than the last year of my drinking, you know. It was I don't answer the phone. It turns out they stop calling if you quit answering the phone. No one comes over. I'm drinking alone. I'm drinking every day, and I'm drunk a lot, you know. And I have no idea what my problem is, but, you know, I am blessed with a lot of others. And because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, I usually just refer to them as my others. And I'm not an alcoholic. I really don't know what an alcoholic is, but I was sick. And I had some others, and I knew that something's wrong with me. And I got the phone book out, and I found a 12-step program, and I thought, I'm going there. I thought, it's me. And what I want to tell you about this 12-step program is that there were two guys from AA in this room, and I don't know how I knew they were from AA. I don't know if they said they were alcoholic, but I love the two AA guys. They were the only ones I wanted to talk. I didn't care for the other people too much. I wanted the two AA guys. I would sit in this meeting and I would do this. Please call on the AA guys. Please call on the AA guys. Please call on the AA guys. I was identifying with the only two alcoholics in that room, and I didn't even know it, you know. And I would go to that meeting, and I would look through the window, and I hope nobody saw me. I'm mortified because I was looking to see if the AA guys were there, because if they weren't, I was going to go home. You know, how sick is that? And so I started to figure out that I thought maybe they hung out in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe. And I got out the phone book, and I found myself in AA meeting, and I thought, unfortunately, I wasn't alcoholic. You know, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm one of those, I might be a couple of these, but I'm not alcoholic. But I picked a meeting, and I thought, I'm just going to sneak into this AA meeting, you know. And I didn't know what the rules were. But I thought, I'm just going to go in, I'm going to say, my name's Sharon, I'm an alcoholic. It was a lie, because I'm not, you know. But I thought if I told them all the different things that I was, I didn't know if they'd let me stay. And so I picked that group in Seattle that I got sober in. They were called the Solution Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were a big book study of about 110 home group members, and I walked down the stairs, and I know that it started at 8, and I know I was walking down the stairs probably at 7:59 and a half, because that is perfect timing. I got 30 seconds to get to my seat, and before I could sit down, this woman slipped me a note. She caught me. Somehow she knew I was new. I didn't even have to say my name, Sharon. She slipped me a piece of paper, and it said, would you like a sponsor? And then underneath it said, or a friend. And I wanted to die that night. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I want to die. I'm all of these crazy things. I'm not alcoholic. And I sat through that meeting. It was 90 60 Minutes. And that group was hardcore. They picked one paragraph in the big book to read. And they would read one paragraph, and for 90 minutes they would talk about it. And I want to die. I'm suicidal. I'm messed up. And I have an ego at the same time. I'm thinking they should call on me. You know, because I can tell them in about, you know, two sentences what we can move on to another paragraph or something. But they didn't call on me. And what happened after that meeting is, you know, they grabbed onto my hands, and I thought we were singing and dancing, and I don't know what we were doing. And when they let go, and this is what I love the most about meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, it happens in the room and it happens on Zoom, is that the room exploded in laughter and conversations and activity. People were sweeping, you know, money was being counted, literature was being sold, and, you know, and I was holding that stupid piece of paper, and up comes this woman, and she says, "What do you think?" And I'm looking at everybody, and I'm just thinking, they don't feel like I do, you know, and somehow I believe that maybe they once did. I don't know how I got that into my head, you know, and she comes up to me, and I thought, look, I've got this contract that she signed. She's, you know, she can't back out of this. And she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Yes." You know, and I'm terrified of this woman. She doesn't know that she needs to treat me carefully because I'm so shy. You know, she just is getting it. She said, "Great, come to my house on Saturday." And I could have lied. I could have gotten out of it. I could have said, "Oh, I work on Saturday." She wouldn't have never known. And somehow out of my mouth, I said yes. And she's like, "Oh, boy, you're great." And I'm like, "What have I done?" And what I don't know about her is that she had 6 months sober. And she had never sponsored anybody. She had just taken the 12 steps with her sponsor, and they told her, "You go get that one." And that one was me. And so she was probably like, "What have I done?" You know, and Saturday I was nauseous and I could have vomited. I go to her house. I am scared to death. She probably is too. And I knocked on that woman's door, and she opened, and I said, "Look, I'm not alcoholic." You know, she's got the door open, and I'm just telling her, "I'm not alcoholic. I told her I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm two of these, I might be one of those." I told her I was sneaking into AA meetings because I really liked when the two AA guys would share. And with her 6 months sobriety, she knew exactly what to say to calm me down. She looked at me, and she opened the door, and she said, "Won't you come in?" And I walked through her door, and she said, "Why don't you sit down?" She was perfect for me. I sat down, and she asked me questions about my drinking, which I thought was peculiar, you know, but I also wanted to die. And I just think, what a great combination, because I answered honestly, you know. And she didn't ask me the question that everybody always asked me. Everybody was always asking me, "Do you always drink this much?" The paramedics asked me that one time, you know. And I remember I wanted to say something eloquent to the paramedics. I wanted to explain to them how much fun I was having. Everybody does this. But I drank so much that I was paralyzed on the bed. I just looked up at the paramedics and I said yes. You know, I think that was years before I got sober. You know, the worst thing anybody ever asked me about my drinking was, we were drinking margaritas at Tequila Willie's. Now that sounds like a fun place. And I don't know, I was just drinking, having some fun, but the friend I was with stopped me and she said, "Sharon, why don't you just take a sip whenever I do?" And I just remember watching her like, "When are we taking a sip? Come on." You know, and that was painful, you know. And so, but this woman didn't ask me things like this. And I don't know what she asked me, but she started to get really excited, you know. And she got out this book, the big book, and she said, she told me we were going to read from the doctor's opinion. We were going to read what you read tonight. I forget who read for more about alcoholism tonight. She said, "You decide if it sounds like you, great." And I think she had a feeling it was going to sound like me, you know, because we read that. And I am going to tell you, I left that woman's house an alcoholic. I have the allergy. I do. I have an allergy to alcohol. When I drink, you know, I heard a speaker say this the other day. He was talking to his sponsor, and his sponsor was asking him, "What happened every single time you drank. And he's saying things like, well, you know, I got in a lot of car accidents. But the sponsor said, but that didn't happen every time you drank. He goes, well, you know, a lot of people got angry at me. And he goes, but that didn't happen every time you drank. And so finally he says, well, what happened to you every time, you know, you took that first drink? And he said, I always had a second. Every time I drank, I always had a second. And, you know, that to me is that phenomenon of craving. And then when I am not drinking, I am weird. And I'm shyer, and I am awkward, and I cannot be with the people of the world, and I am doomed to drink again, because I'll instantly relax, like to say have some fun, not really, you know, I'm doomed to drink again. I have the obsession that this time I'm not going to, you know, hit the fire hydrant. I'm not going to drive down the street backwards. I'm not going to clip off your mirror. I hope you guys aren't from Portland. I'm sorry if you ever got up and your mirror was clipped. I've clipped so many mirrors off cars, you know, and I have the obsession that this time's going to be different. And so what happened to me is that I left her house that Saturday. I snuck into the AA meeting on Tuesday. I left her house Saturday, an alcoholic. I went back to the AA meeting Tuesday, and my world was different. You know, I had a sponsor. She had me already. We were reading the book together. I was alcoholic. And then that night, that group, they told me they would be my home group. And they also told me I was going to be washing cups in the kitchen. And I always thought that I'm happy to do that, but they should have asked me, you know. They should have said, Sharon, would you like to wash cups in the kitchen? But somehow they knew I didn't want to, you know. Somehow they knew that and so they just told me, you know, that you'll be washing the cups, and they gave me a commitment. Even my husband knows better than to ask me things like this. Would you like to take the garbage out? No, I wouldn't, no. You know, would you like to do the dishes? Oh, no, not really. But if he asks me, Sharon, will you take the garbage? Absolutely, I'm there. You know, but my sponsor once said, I got asked to speak somewhere, and I was talking to her, and I said, I don't want to do that. And she said, well, Sharon, stop me if I'm wrong, but you don't ever really want to do anything. And I said, yes, you finally understand me. And she said, so what would make this any different? And I love doing things, but only after they're done. That's the truth about me. Like, I've been looking forward to hanging out with you guys today, you know, but, you know, I'm a great remote control flipper, and I'm gifted at the remote control. You know, this stuff is hard on me because I'm so shy, but afterwards, I always am so glad that God did something to me that made me suit up and show up for stuff like this, because I don't want to miss seeing you guys at New Hope tonight. I don't want to miss stuff like that. You know, that home group sucked me right up. They didn't care about my feelings. I thought somebody should care about my feelings. My sponsor didn't care. The home group didn't care, you know, but it was perfect for me. They made me do horrible things, you know, that I really miss now. You know, I'll just tell you, for somebody as shy as me, they made me go to Denny's after the meeting. I don't know if you've ever had to go to Denny's for coffee, and, you know, I begged them. It's just like, please don't make me do this, please. I even lied to them. I used to ride my bike. I got sober in Seattle, and I'd ride my bike everywhere. I told them, well, I've got my bike tonight, and it's really dangerous to be out this late. And before I know it, they got my bike in John's truck. You know, and they're taking me to Denny's, and I don't know where. Here's the problem about somebody like me at Denny's. Where do you sit? Like, I'm convinced that every seat is taken, and then it'd be weird if I sit at this table where nobody's sitting, and they got that long table, but I'm sure every seat is saved, and then I get all weird about how to sit, and I don't know how to order, you know, and it's just, and then somebody's going to say something to me, which is, you know, it's just somebody's going to, and I have to tell you that everything I learned about making small talk, I learned sitting at Denny's. In pain, you know, and if you're shy tonight, I don't know if there is anybody besides me shy. You guys look pretty normal. You know, I am shy. But if you need to know the secret, you know, they are going to say things like, how are you tonight? They will. And I learn quickly. You can say, yeah, I'm really glad to be here tonight. It doesn't even have to be true. You can lie. I'm really glad to be here tonight. You know, but my trick to learning how to be with the people of the world is, you know, I remember, you know, this one guy, he said, you know, I'm going to go on vacation next week or in 2 weeks. And I thought, okay, make note. He's going on vacation. He's going on vacation. And then next Tuesday I would see him and I'd say, hey, your vacation's coming up, isn't it? And he would say, yeah, it is. And I'm going to buy a new suitcase. And I'd think, make note, new suitcase, new suitcase. Because I wanted to be able to say, did you get that new suitcase? I didn't care at all. I just, it was my trick for how to make conversation, because I was so messed up. I was so messed up. And, you know, I took the 12 steps with that sponsor who had 6 months. And just like I told you guys, I wound up in a place, you know, after trying to get 9 months a couple of times, I wound up sitting in a place just like it looks like New Hope was. And the only thing that didn't work was me. You know, their instructions were great about what to do. I just didn't do it, you know, and that's why it was so dark and depressing to be sitting in this treatment center, you know, with AA not working, you know. But when I got out, my sponsor was just waiting for me and she said, Sharon, how about taking all 12 of the steps? I've never done that, you know, and she had 2 years sober now and she wasn't as nice when she had 6 months sober. She was really nice at 6 months sober. And somehow at 2 months, she kind of got mean and firm about things. But I took all 12 steps and I had a spiritual awakening, you know, and I know I did. I had a spiritual awakening, you know, as the result of the steps. And my life's been good. You know, my life's been good. I am still shy, awkward, and weird. But I can be with the people of the world. I like the people. I can make eye contact with you. I know how to, you know, AA taught me everything about being a part of, you know. I have become a good daughter, which was really important to me. I was not a good daughter for quite a while. I worried my parents to death. My mom and dad, small town, private people, actually went to see a therapist because of me. And that is so wrong. They would never do anything like that, but they didn't know what to do about me. They worried about me. You know, I threatened suicide with them. I wasn't going to do it, but I threatened it with them. They, you know, it's just, they worried about me. And when I got sober, you know, I thought, you know, God, it's taken them a long time to realize that I'm better. You know, they were still like, you know, really weird around me. And it took 7 years before my parents, you know, started to think that maybe AA was a good deal. You know, 7 years. I thought that was a little extreme, but I did so much damage. And today, you know, I'm a good daughter. I get to be a good sister to my sister. She's crazy. She's crazy. You know, I'll probably end with this because I'm getting close to that 30 minutes. My mom is not doing well. I don't know if she's dying. You know, it's just so weird. I've never gone through this before, and it's weird to even say it, but she's not doing well. And so, you know, my crazy dad, my crazy sister, I'm the only normal one. Now, my sister would like, if she could join us right now, she would not agree. But all of our different personalities are interwoven in this really kind of sad time. And the good thing for me is that thank God for AA, you know, because it's the hardest time I think I've ever had in sobriety. You know, I almost thought today, at one point I thought, I'm getting on a plane, I'm calling Bill, he'll understand, there's no way I can, you know, but there's no call for it today. And, you know, my mom is either, she's going down or, oh, she's looking pretty good. And so I don't know what's happening. But I'm a good daughter and I get to be there for my dad. And, you know, I get to be patient with my crazy sister and all of her insanity. And, you know, and we had a conference call right before this with my mom, my dad, my sister, me, and my niece, who is also Sharon. She's named after me. And we were just laughing. And that is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were laughing. My dad, this is exciting stuff. My dad was cooking his first TV dinner of his entire life in the oven. He turned the oven on. He set the timer for 30 minutes. But he was confused about when the timer goes off, how does the oven turn off? And we were just, he had no idea how to turn off the oven. And I'm going to treasure that memory for a long time of, you know, us trying to explain to him how to turn off the oven. I love my family. I love my life. I'm grateful, you know, to AA for the life it's given me. Hard times, good times. I don't think it matters. I need you guys. I need Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a better deal. And I know you guys are headed out, and I'll probably, you know, stop there. But please come hang out with me in San Jose. Hang out with Bill and Vasilia. We watch for you to get out. We really want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous to get you hooked in. So with that, I will stop on the nose at 30 minutes.
Wow. Thank you so much, Sharon. What a wonderful story. So we are now headed into the discussion portion of the meeting. I know that our friends at New Hope have to leave at 8:30.
I'm going to finish off the meeting by myself.
Oh, fantastic.
Hooray.
So, yeah, so I'll turn the meeting back over to Sharon, and she can pick on some people to share. It's a cornucopia of people to choose from, Sharon.
It is. And Mike can't share because he doesn't have the ability to. And then one of our squares is just Bill repeated. And so we've got me and is it Jesse or Courtney? Who's with us? Jesse and Bill. Jesse, hey, come join me. I'm going to call on you first. I'm really glad to meet you.
Yeah, it's good. It's nice to hear your story, too. It's nice to meet you. My family's from San Jose, so I would love to see you. Yeah, and I see Bill a lot when we're able to go out. So where should I start? Is there a topic?
I wasn't asked to pick one. I'm a rule follower now.
So I guess I'll just go with motivation. What motivates me to keep coming to these meetings? I like to stay interested in AA. It seems when things go dull for me, I lose interest. And I really want the sobriety, so I try to do things to make me stay here. Like, what is it that motivates me today every time I wake up to be sober? And lately it's just been like to help these girls survive. And it's like, I know I have to focus on my rehabilitation, but since I'm excelling so well, I feel like I could take it on. And so, today, during church, after church, I was inspired to sign up for Bible college. And I was questioning about taking the counselor's course to help to become a counselor here. It's just something that came to me today. So I don't know. And I usually do things spontaneously, like follow my heart, like whenever it beats a certain direction. So that's what's motivating me right now, is just saving these girls. We lost a girl yesterday, and I was really bummed out. And I become a house mom on Tuesday, so I'm, like, trying to find a way to hook these girls in, like you said, and, like, make this new way of life, interesting for them. Because they all end up here because they want to stop. They need to stop, you know? Why not continue and better yourself? So I just really, if you guys have any, like, things you guys do to hook these newcomers, just go ahead and send it our way at New Hope, because I really want these girls to make it. Living my life sober, after my accidental overdose, I lost 100 pounds, I had a fiancé, a stepdaughter, and my second chance to getting my hair license. And, like, I had taken care of an elderly couple with first-stage dementia. And, like, I really had my stuff together soberly. After my grandpa died, I don't do well with grieving. And then my grandmother died. And then my great-grandmother died. And then my best friend died. So it made this year, being homeless for my first time, I'm high maintenance. Like, there's no way, like, this girl could be homeless. But it's true, like, I was. So it's just, I have to grow up now. In a sense, like, don't have my grandma or my great-grandma or my best friend. And, like, I feel like all three of them women strong spiritually now. And I just really, really hope to make them proud and be a strong influence on these girls, like those girls that I lost were to me. So that's my new motivation. But other than that, yeah. Bill, how about you?
And now we've got Mike too.
Yeah, I just noticed Mike joined it. Mike, do you have a mic now?
Yeah, I got it on my laptop, and I still have the other one recording, but I just wanted to get on and share. Thank you so much, Sharon, for sharing. I've been around here for a while and heard a lot of different things, and yours is a very good story. You know, yours is a very inspiring story, and I'm glad to hear it. I'm just grateful to be sober. You know, I just wanted to get on and share that, you know, I'm grateful to be sober. My sobriety date's January 2nd, 1986. So I've been around a while and heard a lot of different things. And, you know, there's been good times and bad times, but the good times way outweigh the bad times in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And the people that I've met help me on a daily basis. I get to go to one live meeting a week. It's on Sunday mornings out in the park, and it's really nice to be able to do that. The rest of the time, I'm on Zoom, and you know, that's the best I can do. I've gotten because I stayed sober, I've gotten old, so I have a hard time driving, and you know, I can't make night meetings, and. You know, I'm just grateful to be able to do daytime meetings on Zoom and stuff. And I'm grateful to be able to record you and have you on our website. And I'm going to go back over and put in the chat what the website address is. So I just wanted to share. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thanks, Mike.
Bill.
Yeah, so, wow, so we're lucky it's gone down to the bottom of the barrel here, but, mm-hmm. I'm so glad to be with you. There were a number of things, that you said, Sharon, that really, got my attention, kind of resonated with me, and I want to say that I'm really glad to be here. Because I too could be sitting in front of the television with the remote and binging on some you know, mindless chatter, but you were saying that you when you were younger you felt awkward and that you really wanted to be cute and funny, and I think you've achieved cute and funny, The thing that's really I find humorous is the way that you describe how I think. When you were talking about the way that that you think about how other people are perceiving you and how that changes over time, I kept thinking to myself, wow, you know, Sharon and I really think alike. So, but you described it in a way that was endearing. It was funny. I appreciated that. You mentioned that relapse isn't a requirement, but it is something that many of us have in our story. And I like to think of it that I've tried staying sober with dates in every one of the 12 months. And the one that stuck for me was in April, the 11th of April of 2005. And so I think just my research suggests that April is the best month to get and stay sober. But, you know, hey, that's just my opinion, right? That's worked out for me. I have, like I said, tried all of them. And you were talking about the dates that you had, and you know, the 229.92 and the 29th year, and that got me thinking about numbers. And my very first, like, I guess on purpose sobriety date was February 14th. That's Valentine's Day, for crying out loud, of 2004. And my current sobriety date, again, is 4-11-05, and I had never really thought this much about the numbers, but if you add up the digits, those are both equal for whatever that – I mean, that doesn't mean anything, right? It really doesn't mean anything, but I thought it was just a funny coincidence. And you also talked about one of the things that happens to you when you're drinking, that it makes you thirsty, and I've often found that drinking makes me thirsty, an unquenchable thirst. It reminds me of a time when one of my best friends from high school. He was one of the guys that showed up at my surprise party. I don't remember you talking about having a surprise party. You know the surprise party that they have for you. Well, there's no bounce house and pony at these kind of surprise parties. It's when these people that really, you know, are close to you, show up, and they have these prepared letters in their hands, and they read them to you, and they all start off very nice, right? They all start off with great memories and wonderful things, and then they all get really dark, and they all in unison seem to say the same thing, and that is, you know, that, hey, dude, you need to go get some help, and you need to do it today, and that's how my journey first began, and I ended up at a treatment facility, and while I was there, I found that I have a keen ability to diagnose other people. It's just a gift, you know. I mean, don't waste your gifts, right? You know, what I've learned since then is that when I'm diagnosing others, what I'm really trying to do is divert myself from looking within, And so, as a result of the 12 steps that we talk about, I've been able to implement some real change in my life, and my life has become profoundly better as a result of doing the things that we do here in AA. You know, I don't know. I've known people that have taken a different, maybe a different path towards the same end. This you know, spiritual awakening and this pursuit of a consistently better life. But in my case, I met a guy that he wasn't my first sponsor, but he was the first one that took me through the 12 steps. And after we had finished that work, he moved out of town, and I got connected with another guy that was local, and we went through those 12 steps again. And what I found was that the second guy had a slightly different mechanical approach. Right? I mean, he didn't have exactly the same kinds of things, but they were all very similar. And as a result of going through the process a little differently, it seemed to me like I was getting still newer perspectives on myself and the people around me, and the power that makes this universe survive, I guess. So I've continued to do that. I've continued to stay active in pursuing work with a sponsor. And one of the first things, early in the process, my sponsor got me involved in service. And that was in a couple of different forms. He got me into sponsorship and trying to guide other people. And, you know, I found in my journey here, I found that for one reason or another, I continue to forget some of the most important things over and over. And what that means is then I get to learn the same lessons over and over. And one of the lessons that I got to learn today was just how important it is to have a sponsor and to and to not be afraid to pick up the phone and call even when I think I should know the answer, and especially when my emotions are involved. And, you know, I haven't yet been able to find a way to survive in this new sober life without emotions. And I suppose that's a great blessing, but you know, it's messy business working with other alcoholics. It's messy business. And it was messy for the guys who the first guys that tried to help me, because I wasn't really you know, an alcoholic. And much like you described, Sharon, I could identify maybe with some other things, but I just didn't really see. And even if I was an alcoholic, I mean, surely I could stop if I really wanted to, you know? And I found out for myself I couldn't. And so it's funny. I think God has a funny way of sending me to me. And I get to work with guys that are just as stubborn and you know, selfish and pigheaded and determined as I can be. And this weekend I've been dealing with, you know, a friend, a guy who's become a friend who has, you know, gone back to drinking. And he's done himself a lot of harm. Him and his family are going to be suffering for a while because of his decisions. And it's hard not to, it's hard for me not to have a range of emotions about that. I'm angry at my friend for the decision he made, and I'm sad for the pain his family's going through, and I'm questioning whether I could have said or done something different, and I know that's silly. But those thoughts still go through my mind. And there's a part of me that wants to, to punish him for making the decision that he's made. And there's a part of me that wants to try to save him. And that's a whole lot of different parts and a lot of different emotions. And, you know, what I do with those kinds of conflicting, emotions and thoughts is I find myself often paralyzed and I don't know what to do. I think of lots of things to do, but just as soon as I think I've got figured out what I should do, then I come up with an argument for why that's the wrong thing to do. And so then I just don't do anything. And, what I did today is what I've been trained to do. I called my sponsor, someone who's not emotionally invested in this situation. And I told him what I just told you about what my friend did, how I feel about it and how I think about it. And he was able to give me some very, very practical advice. And I don't know why that, you know, the practical advice, once he gives it to me, it's like, I think, well, of course, why didn't you come up with that? Right. I mean, that's so perfectly logical. And there's just something I suspect it may be related to my ego or I don't know, but there's something that seems to keep me from seeing, the best possible next step sometimes. And so I find that, you know, again, I still need a sponsor. 16 years sober and I need a sponsor. I need somebody that can guide me. And Sharon, I'm so delighted that people like you, are willing to overcome their maybe preference to do something else or their fear to bare their soul to strangers. Because what happens when I rub elbows with people like you and people like me is I get reminded that I'm perfectly human. I have strengths and weaknesses and I want to be better tomorrow. And that's possible if I avail myself of the process. So anyway, quite enough out of me, but, thank you so much for joining us here this evening. I'm glad Mike could join us and I'm so glad that our friends from New Hope could join us. I think we'll call that a wrap. I've got some closing announcements that I'll make. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. I invite you to come early and to stay out.